Blog Talk Radio.
For the next hour, we're spending some time with teacher researchers and the people who support them as we pay a visit to the Southern Arizona Writing Project's local teacher research and inquiry community. Now, Southern Arizona Writing Project, like many writing projects, has been supporting teacher research and inquiry programs, both as continuity programs for current teacher consultants and also as in-service opportunities for area teachers. Now, we know this is a time when many folks in education might worry that we're losing the tradition of inquiry and reflection-based programs for teachers. But Southern Arizona Writing Project wants to say, hey, wait a minute, all of us are still here. We're still doing this work. And unless listeners, you think that Southern Arizona is among the last programs standing, we've seen from Susan Lytle and Marilyn Cochran-Smith's excellent book, Inquiry as Stance, Practitioner Research for the Next Generation, that actually the teacher research movement is still very much alive. And even here in the United States, where we worry that educational policy might seem antithetical to the kind of work that goes on in research and inquiry programs. So we're hoping that this is an area where you'll want to join us as we talk with four wonderful guests about how one particular writing project designs and supports teacher research. We're also going to hear about several recent studies that have come out of the research and inquiry community at Southern Arizona. So for the next hour, we're pleased to welcome Sharon Miller. Sharon is one of the co-directors of the Southern Arizona Writing Project and directs the research and inquiry program there. We're also going to hear from Lori Medina, an English language development ELD teacher at Billy Lane Law Firm Middle School. We're going to hear from Denise Angerhofer, an elementary special ed teacher in Sunnyside School District, and also a therapeutic horseback riding instructor with TROT, Therapeutic Riding of Tucson. And finally, we're going to hear from Leo Glashow-Mandel, a high school teacher and instructional team leader for the English department at Catalina Foothills High School. All of these teachers are from the general Tucson area and have participated with different teacher research and inquiry programs at Southern Arizona Writing Project. So first, let me welcome all our guests. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
So let's start with Sharon. Sharon, if we could start with you. You have been working with teacher research and inquiry for a long time, first at the Maryland Writing Project, where you and I met, and in Maryland schools, and now at the Southern Arizona Writing Project. So you're a perfect person to give us the big picture here. Could you tell us first, for our listeners for whom this might be new, what is this thing called teacher research and inquiry?
Well, teacher research is an intentional and systematic investigation of teaching and learning in the classroom, and it's done by the teacher, not by an outside researcher. And the daily life in the classroom becomes tangible data that supports that inquiry. So if we think about what teachers and students think and do and make during the course of the day, all of that can be gathered into a body of artifacts that represent the data. Now, it always looks fairly similar depending on some variations, but pretty much teacher research begins with identifying a question, and that question is usually derived from what Susan Lytle calls a felt need, the gap between what you've got and what you want as outcomes of your teaching. Mm-hmm. And so you identify that question, that gap, and you work to close that gap by perhaps implementing an intervention or a teaching strategy, and you begin to collect data, both qualitative and quantitative. It isn't just test scores. It isn't just the AIMS, which is Arizona's Instrument to Measure Standards, the standardized tests mm-hmm. that states have, but student attitudes and ideas, teachers keep journals and make observations, and they ask students their ideas.
So Sharon, if I could just jump in to just hit something and ask you a bit about what you just said, just to be clear, that gap between where we are and where we want to go, that's really a teacher's interest in improving his or her outcomes as an educator. So it sounds like what you're saying is that this is really driven by us as teachers, and want our desire to get better.
Exactly. It's all about improving teaching and learning in the classroom. All teachers, whether they are doing teacher research or not, want to improve the learning of their students. That's what it's all about. So we take that data that we've gathered and analyze it in a supportive community, and we can modify the intervention. This is one of the things that surprises a lot of people when they come new to teacher research, because they're used to some of the more traditional forms of research with unchanging variables and the researcher being on the outside and objective, and they have experimental and control groups, and none of those things occur in teacher research because the teacher is closely engaged in the research itself and in the teaching practice that she's examining. So we can change things. We don't do experimental and control groups because if I'm trying to implement an intervention to close that gap we defined, then how could I possibly deny that intervention to some of my students? If I believe that's how I'm going to close the gap,
So I'm going to be trying some things as a teacher. They're going to be informed by my sense of best practice and really looking at my young people. It's going to give me a path that I'm going to try to work with, and I'm collecting this data and I'm analyzing it in, I think you said, a supportive community. And I may find that it's actually a promising direction or a dead end, and I would, of course, as a teacher then try some new things, take it in a different direction. So actually, it sounds as if what you're saying is this work, the data collection and even the involvement of my students is helping me refine a practice as much as study a practice.
Yes, it is refining the practice and studying the practice, and it is very closely aligned with teaching practice. It is what teachers do every day. Think on our feet. We change the lesson plan when we see all those blank stares. So we make those adjustments because always our first and foremost goal is to improve teaching and learning in that classroom.
And what are some of the approaches a teacher researcher might take to kind of study this intervention or study a situation in his or her classroom?
Well, you might choose to, it depends on where you've identified the gap. We can probably identify a dozen different gaps in any given
at any time, yeah.
At any time. But it would probably be the one that was the most troubling. Often I tell my teacher researchers, who's the kid that keeps you awake at night that you worry about? So you might want to focus on that individual student and determine what it is you need to do to make a difference so that he or she can be successful. You might also choose a subpopulation. If you have that small group of students who are resistant to everything you try to do, you might determine an intervention that will change their minds, change their attitudes. You may go with doing a whole class or study the learning strategy or an intervention that someone suggested. I always think about teachers in the Summer Institute going back to the classroom with dozens of ideas and trying them all out. How do you know which one's good? Which one?
Right.
With your class and with your students.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Sharon.
No. Go ahead.
So actually a range of approaches that teacher researchers can take based on their situation, based on their questions. But it sounds like what you're saying also, though, is that this participation in a supportive community, you mentioned that a little bit earlier, is important and may be part of the difference between just kind of thinking on your feet and having colleagues to be able to really help you look systematically and critically at something. Have you seen, over the period of your involvement, any trends or patterns in how teachers are supported or engaged as researchers and have access to this kind of supportive community?
What I see as the biggest difference from time to time is how teachers come to participate in teacher research and who they're doing it with and for. If they are doing it for their district or if they're doing it for themselves, if they're doing it with others that they've chosen to be with and who have like-minded ideas, it can be very, very different in that kind of an approach. We're even seeing pre-service teachers in their preparation for teaching being introduced to it, and universities offering courses in teacher research when teachers are pursuing their higher degrees. So we can only hope that they'll take back to the classroom an inquiry stance and continue to do that and seek out his community.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
And so in these different communities, it sounds as what you're saying, there's this kind of core process a teacher researcher is going to go through that is going to be similar across all of those. Mm-hmm. What kind of difference do these different settings potentially make for teacher researchers?
It all depends on the degree to which they get the kind of support that they need. I've seen school and district programs that have been really, really bad and didn't do what they were supposed to do. We had a district here where the superintendent suddenly declared one year that everybody, every teacher in the district would do teacher research and every teacher would study how to raise their reading scores. And needless to say, it was a disaster, and I don't see any hope that they'll ever recover it. We have a district like Sunnyside and Tankaverde, the two school districts that we work with, where they are committed to giving teachers the kind of freedom they need to pursue their own questions and focus on improving learning in their own classroom. We see something entirely different.
Mm-hmm. So it's not a magic bullet. It is possible for this to go awry as well.
It can. And I think one of the most important roles that the writing project can play is offering that time and space and resources for both formal and informal groups and for tapping into those districts who may be thinking about an action research or a teacher research program as professional development so that we keep our ear to the public discussion and say, maybe we can go forth and influence that district and go up and say, we'll help. What can we do to help you put this program into place and make it work?
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to hear from you some of the ways that Southern Arizona organizes the work, but just one observation. It does seem an interesting conundrum for a writing project. You want to be able to have support, the support of community. You want teacher researchers to be supported and listened to and have access to opportunities to do this work. But you don't want that support to turn into a kind of mandate that actually will make it impossible to have the kind of intellectual and professional climate that teacher research thrives in. It sounds like a balancing act
really?
That writing projects help with.
Yes. And one of the nice things, too, about the Sunnyside and the Tankaverde programs that we support, they are voluntary. The teachers are not told to have to do it. And that's one of the things that I often say to a superintendent or a principal when meeting with them and talking about this, is that it has to be voluntary. You can't just throw everybody in the room together. Everybody's doing it this way.
A significant lesson that we keep learning again and again, the importance of that. Well, tell us, Sharon, just give us a picture. You've mentioned Sunnyside and Tankaverde school districts. You've mentioned a couple of things. Give us a quick overview of the ways that Southern Arizona Writing Project organizes teacher research programs.
Well, we have the two components, our district partnership, and you heard about the Sunnyside a little bit and Tankaverde, and they're very different. Sunnyside is about a 10-year-old program, and it was designed entirely by teachers and led by teachers, and it's a very sophisticated professional development program at this point. Tanca Verde is, we're working in a new developing partnership with them, and what they're doing is sending teachers to our online program. And so whether or not that translates into an on-site program, that remains to be seen. But the central core of our program is the online Teacher Research and Inquiry Community, which was formerly known as the Teacher Research and Inquiry Institute.
Mm-hmm.
We took it online as a means of reaching out to more distant teachers and maybe helping work with teachers who are terribly busy, maybe too busy to come to too many regular meetings.
So this started as a face-to-face program and then became an online
yes.
program? Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we offer it for graduate credit or recertification hours, and it's an open institute, so it's open to the entire educational community. And sometimes people from our summer institutes go on to teacher research, and sometimes teachers who come into our teacher research program go on then to the summer institute. So it's a nice balance.
So the online teacher research and inquiry community is broadly open, and you may get individuals deciding to take that. And then the Sunnyside and Tanca Verde programs are really designed in partnership with those school districts for teachers in those districts.
Yeah.
Is that the case? Okay.
Yes, that's very much the case.
So we actually probably should move to some of the great studies that we have an opportunity to hear in this hour. And of the teacher researchers joining us, we actually have folks from both of those programs, right, Sharon?
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. We have one from the online community and two from Sunnyside.
So let's start with the Sunnyside partnership, and that will let us hear from Lori and Denise. And Lori, if we could start with you. So the program in Sunnyside, you're a Sunnyside district teacher, and Sharon described this as a long-term and sophisticated program. Can you tell us a little bit about that program and how you got involved as a teacher in the district?
Yes, I was actually recommended to take an action research as an opportunity. And we have, in our school district, we have the option for going, it's called career ladder, and we could either go the standard route, which is people come in and observe, or you could do action research, which is where, like Sharon mentioned, it's more of a journey looking into how to improve your own instruction. And I, as an ELD teacher, I teach a completely different group of students, and I am one of two teachers, and soon to be the only teacher in my school that teaches students who are either new to the country, and I teach multi-grade level, so they're very challenging. And a standard observation by someone coming in and, you know, just kind of taking a look at my classroom, they probably really wouldn't know what to look for, and it doesn't really benefit me as a teacher as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like the action research program because I got a chance to, or I have the chance to, look at my own instruction and take time and really investigate things that are troubling me about instruction, like this year, I had to look at oral. I was looking at oral language development and how to get my students to actually produce English.
Uh-huh.
And that may seem a simple task, but it's not. It's very, very difficult and challenging. And I wanted to step it up a notch this year, but I wasn't quite sure how to go about doing that.
Uh-huh.
And with action research, you have the opportunity to talk to, as Sharon mentioned, it's a very supportive community, so you have the opportunity to talk to other teachers and get some feedback and some ideas, and then go back into the classroom and try it out and see if it works, and if it doesn't, then you know you need to try something else. But it's a really great opportunity for teachers to look at themselves, their instruction, and how to improve it.
So that's really interesting, and it's interesting how your school district offered then a couple of different approaches, and you could see how for your situation, actually you could get more feedback and more support through this route because of your situation than you could through what some districts might think would be an equivalent context through an observation, I'm guessing observation and mentoring. But this gave you access to a broader range of brains to help you think through your problem, I'm guessing.
Exactly. And you got when you're observed, either even if you're observed through a mentor, it's still I hate to use the expression like a dog and pony show, but it's you're trying to impress them. You're not really looking at yourself. And that's what I really like about action research, because it gives me the opportunity to really look at, well, what am I doing? Why isn't this working? And how can I fix it without that added pressure of someone,
right,
you know, feeling like you're on the spot? And
right,
that way I can really take a look and dissect and, you know,
right,
troubleshoot
right
things.
So you really are able, in fact, it's a valuable thing to be able to identify a problem you want to solve, not something to hide, but your problems are important. They're at the centerpiece. Tell us a little bit about your study then, sort of what was your question, what was your interest, how did you come to it?
Well, as I mentioned briefly, I am an ELD teacher. I teach students who come in who are new to the country or have been in the country for several years and who are not proficient in English. And according to Arizona law, they all have to stay with me in my classroom for 4 hours a day until they reach proficiency. So that means I could have a group of 6th, 7th, and 8th graders all in one classroom at all different language levels. And that's quite challenging. And
different periods of time in the country? You might you have some that are more recent arrivals?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Right.
So you've got all different, a myriad of language levels and age levels and maturity levels. But the bottom line is my job is to get them to read, write, speak, and comprehend English so that they can get mainstreamed into regular, and I use quotations, regular classrooms for language arts. So they, in my experience, they all do very well reading, writing, and comprehending English, but the speaking, the oral language development, is always a problem. And what I noticed last year during my action research study, one of the things that was beginning to bother me was that it was affecting their writing skills. Because when you're writing, when you edit and you go through the editing process, you can generally hear your mistakes when you read it out loud. But if you don't know the language, you can't hear the mistakes that you're making. So my question was, well, how do I get them to produce more oral academic language, have them feel confident with it so that they can use it in their other classrooms? Because they do go to a math and a science class with regular native speakers.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, in those math and science classes, they generally receive D's and F's.
Okay.
So my goal was to get them, hopefully, to feel confident speaking in English and then apply their oral language development skills into other classrooms.
And with that particular emphasis, I'm hearing also on academic language and how important that is. It's not something you're going to pick up around the mall or on the playground necessarily.
Exactly. And so, and also with their, I was looking at, for my study, I was looking at their writing skills as well to see if it improved their writing skills.
So talk a little bit about what you learned.
Well, there was a couple of things that I did at first. I started some activities because one of the things that I know just as an ELD teacher, I have to work on lowering the effective filter. And if people aren't sure what that means, that's getting the children or students to feel comfortable enough to take risks so that they can, you know, they'll say a word even if they're unsure if it's correct or not in English.
Right.
And by doing that, I did some activities that were kind of game-based, you know, fun activities to get them involved in laughing and participating. But after a while, that gets pretty old. And that's not, you know, I wanted to step it up a notch. I wanted the activities to be a little bit more academically based. But I wasn't sure how to go about doing that.
So a great place to start. You wouldn't, but you had to go someplace next.
Right, exactly. And I wasn't sure where, because as also one of my weaknesses is oral language development. I've never really felt confident evaluating it and introducing it, and you know, I really wanted to take a look at that. So while I was kind of in that limbo stage, I was working with a student one day in a reading intervention program that was mandated by our school district. She, and what I was supposed to do was introduce vowel sounds with letters and have them pull out the vowel sounds that, like, you know, the letter A and E, etc. And the student started looking at me, and a tear fell down her cheek, and I was like, what did I do? What did I do wrong? And she immediately just said, you're treating me like a baby. I already know that they're vowel sounds. I know that they make sounds. Please stop. You're insulting me. Mm. And that just, you know,
yeah.
It kind of sent me into a different direction in terms of instruction, because I knew right then and there that I wasn't, if I kept doing these fun activities just for the affective filter to lower that, I wasn't really pushing them, and they needed to be pushed. Mm-hmm. So I went in and I did some more research, and I looked at literature circles, and I was, you know, I thought, well, this could work because I have a small classroom. Literature circles require differentiated instruction, so I knew I could give different roles to different students based on their language level, and I could possibly introduce grade-level texts to see how it went. Mm-hmm. I was a little unsure at first because I wasn't sure if the texts that I was going to give to them were going to be too over their heads, if they were going to be able to deal with it. But I knew if I did enough scaffolding and if I supported it enough with background and a lot of teacher-guided instruction, that it might work. Mm-hmm. And it turned out to be a phenomenal discovery. And, you know, unfortunately, I figured this out second semester, so I only had a couple of months to work with it. But we got through some wonderful texts like Thank You, Ma'am, and The All-American Slurp, and No Guitar Blues by Gary Soto. And it was just, you know, they were eating it up. And the great thing about it is they felt like they were being pushed. And
yeah.
Every time that I gave them something difficult to do, like I would have them create standard-based questions, you know, like author's purpose or main idea or inferencing questions. They would create the questions and then supply the answer as well, you know, in an A, B, C, D multiple-choice format. And every time I would give them that activity, they could do it. And they were, you know, they were so proud of themselves. And the final results is that the girl that cried at the beginning because I was insulting her intelligence, she just soared. And she went from being an emergent, which is very, very, very basic English speaker, not knowing many English words, to a high intermediate, which is close to proficient in
wow.
1 year. And you just don't hear that.
So this has really opened up a sort of an entirely new curricular approach that you can be refining over time.
Exactly, and that's my plan next year, is to look deeper into literature circles and get it going from the beginning of the year and see how well the students do. And, you know, it really also depends that you've really got to know your students and know what they're capable of. And I knew these students, they can, you know, just because they couldn't speak English, they could still think, you know, they could think complex thoughts, but they just couldn't communicate it. And the gift of communication really just helped them become just incredible students.
Yeah. I certainly have heard many teacher researchers that when they describe their study, there is a kind of inciting incident in a way, like the one that that you've described, that really opens up a need for change or a need for a new direction. So that I hear in many cases, and it's also there in your story. But another piece, and I think we'll move now to Denise, there's an opportunity to learn something because you're in a very specific situation, such as your, Lori, in your case, the ELD program, and the opportunity to think through a curricular approach that might be more promising for other teachers. We'll talk about that later, sharing with other teachers. But this notion that where you are is a setting for learning something that's very particular to you, really, Denise, also relates to you. So let's bring you in now, if we could.
Okay. So
your situation is in some ways an unusual teaching situation, but also gives you an opportunity to learn some very specific things that might not be easy for other teachers to learn, and we're kind of learning them through you. Could you describe your teaching situation and the focus of your work?
Yes, I'm an elementary special ed teacher in the Sunnyside School District, and I work with students who have cognitive impairment and physical impairment. And the kids that I'm working with this year are ages 5 to 7. And so I was really interested in trying to find unique ways to motivate them and work on same kind of communication issues, but mostly just learning to speak and use language. And I'm also a therapeutic writing instructor through the TROT program in Tucson, which is a unique program that uses horseback riding as a means of helping people with disabilities to enjoy horses.
And this notion of riding therapy, it's a larger movement than just Tucson.
Yes. Oh, yes. It's actually international. There's different programs throughout the world. And also in the United States, the National Association for the Riding for the Handicapped is the NARA Association. And TROT is a member of that. And so I've been certified through that program as well to teach.
And we should say for all our listeners that we'll be putting links to all of these things in the chat room. And if you're listening to an on-demand episode, you'll be able to find the links on the web. But that particular, so Denise, that's a very particular situation. And within that then, what was the impetus for your study? What were you looking at?
Well, I'm also a member of the Action Research Program through Career Ladder, and I've been able to get donations and money so that I can take my class once a week to the TROT program. So during the school day, we actually go out to the horseback riding program, and I teach kids on horseback. So I wanted to use the experiences they were having on horseback to coordinate with the things that they're learning in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of unique in that I'm actually able to teach what I'm teaching in the classroom on horseback. So I developed my study around that.
And you mentioned that you're working with young people who might have both or either cognitive impairments or physical. So this blend of something physical and something cognitive at the same time, I would imagine is a very special setting for your young people to be in, for them to be riding.
Yes, and they just love it so much. Every day when they'll be asking me, are we going to the horses today? Is the horses today? And even if they can't speak, I had students who was teaching sign actually started signing horses at me and asking to go, which was just thrilling to both myself and their parents.
Wow. So your goal was to build a connection, a stronger connection between this once a week, it sounds like, once a week opportunity with the horses and other things that you were trying to do more broadly in as their teacher. Is that part of what you were looking at, how to make the bridge between some of the curricular things you were interested in and the therapeutic riding situation?
Yes. So I actually was looking at how if I was teaching even like the letters of the alphabet in the classroom, I could teach the alphabet out in the riding arena where I would put letters up around the arena and then the children who are on the horses who also have, I have volunteers who assist me with that. So I just don't put children on and tell the horses go.
right.
Many people are kind of concerned that that's what happens. But I have specifically trained courses and volunteers through the TROT program that assist me with this program. And then, you know, I will, part of the writing lesson is incorporated in, and they have to show me the letters or tell me the letters around the arena as they move their horses to those specific letters and then tell me. And it was amazing to me how many times that children I didn't think knew letters were actually able to go over and start to tell me letters. And then I was interested to see if it would translate back to the classroom. And it did seem to do that, as I would, I can't do standards testing with these children, but I did a lot of observational testing and comparing results. And every child did improve in that.
So it sounds absolutely wonderful and amazing, and I can kind of visualize the situation with the horses. I'm sort of picturing it. But I'm guessing that even though this was very specific to your young people in this program, that some of what you learned might have implications for the rest of us. Do you have some notion about what would translate or what you would say to teachers more broadly? Were some of the things that came out of this study for you?
Well, one of the books I had read was talking about the fact that we need movement helps us to learn. And so I really was trying to get a lot of movement into the class. And I think that's one of the things that we really need to look at through our whole education system, how important it is for the brain to be learning and active, that we need to move.
That's powerful, yeah. Yeah, we do, the more sort of regular the situation, and often the older the student, the more they're locked into desks almost 4 or 6 hours a day.
Yes. And I think one of the most important books that I've been reading for the research was about Jensen's book that Teaching with the Brain and Mind, Eric
mm-hmm.
Jensen.
Mm-hmm.
And he really inspired me to really look at movement and ways to increase the brain to incorporate that into learning.
Wow.
And then it's so exciting for me. I love horses, and it just translated for me to be able to put my students on horses where the overflow from the horses moving and trotting and they're laughing and the giggling and just the fun of moving helped students retain and begin to use their brains more.
That's wonderful. We'll put also a link to the Jensen book in the chat room because, as you say, this notion of teaching with the brain and mind and questions about movement and how we organize learning experiences translate across all of us. So we'll put that in the chat room for our listeners. Thank you. Now, both Denise, you and Lori were both part of the Sunnyside program, and you both described the connection to the career ladder model. We're going to move now to Leah. Leah, you were part of what Sharon described as the online community that grew out of the Teacher Research and Inquiry Institute. Could you tell us a little bit about the online community? It's a slightly different setting from the Sunnyside. Tell us a little bit about it and how you got involved in that opportunity.
Sure. Well, it was nice to be involved in the online community because it was the first time that Sharon had tried it with the Research Institute. So she was conducting research on how successful this format was as we were working. So it was a nice model to have her research going along with ours at the same time. And I was the only teacher involved in the Institute that wasn't also working with a school group. So I was with several other Tankaverde teachers.
Uh-huh.
And I became involved because I was finishing up my master's degree in English, and this was an option that I had to take for credit, and it was something that I became interested in when I was involved in the Summer Institute through the Writing Project in 2008, and when I realized I could get graduate credit for it, I thought, well, that's a bonus because I'm very busy, it's online, and I get credit for it.
And it gave you a continuity opportunity after the, it sounds like then after the Summer Institute, that I'm thinking to what Sharon was saying before, that you finish the Summer Institute, you have lots of ideas you want to put in practice.
Mm-hmm.
Where's your community to help you think through that? Is that the case for you?
Absolutely, definitely. And I especially enjoyed it because with the rest of my master's work, so much of it was removed from what I was doing in my classroom. It was very theoretical and kind of esoteric, and it was nice to be able to do something that bridged the gap between academia and the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Which is a great thing to observe about teacher research and inquiry in general, and especially when it's part of a larger program, it allows for that movement between what we're learning in the rest of our academic program and the situation of our classroom. So thanks for introducing that idea.
Sure.
Give us a window into your study then.
Okay, well, it came out of not one situation, but kind of a series of, I'll say, irritations that I started to develop with what my students were doing and with the work that I was getting from them. So I had been teaching 10th grade honor students in a school district where the students are really motivated and everyone wants to get an A, but I was noticing that desire to get an A was more important to them than what they learned about themselves as writers, and they didn't care about their own writing process. They cared about what I needed to tell them to do to get an A.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so I got
frustrated.
There's
a situation that translates to many of us, yeah.
Yeah, and I can't do anything about the grade system, but I thought, what can I do so that I can help them to become more independently invested in their writing process so that they feel like they have agency in what they're writing, and also so that when I read papers, I'm not just reading the same paper over and over again because it's what the kids think that I want them to write.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I was looking at that, and I started with using writing portfolios, and I changed it to look at process portfolios so that the students were keeping track of their writing process instead of just the products, because process is the most significant piece there. And then as it kept going, I realized that I was more at fault here than I thought that I was in the feedback that I was giving my students.
Oh, that's
interesting. I couldn't expect them to be more independent if the comments I gave them on their papers told them exactly what to do to improve their writing. I wasn't respecting them enough as writers to make those decisions themselves.
So just to jump in and ask one question. So,
sure.
So that would suggest then that through this study you did a number of things, and one of which was really just to stop and look at your own feedback. Did you put that in place as kind of a data collection and analysis moment just to look at what you were saying in the writing from which you saw this notion of directed feedback? How did that come about?
Yeah, I think it actually came about from another course that I was taking in composition pedagogy.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I was doing a lot of reading of the expressivists, and that was not an area I was interested in previously. I thought, oh, expressivism, that's very, very nice and new agey, but it's not something that's very academic. But in looking into it a little bit more, I realized that that was exactly what I was looking for, because I was just taking control over my students' papers. I was correcting their grammar in the same place that I was suggesting they reorganize their paper. So I made them believe that those two things were of equal importance. Oh, you have a bad comma there. Oh, put your ideas in a different order. The students are going to fix what they find to be the easiest. I was rephrasing their writing instead of suggesting that they might think about a different way to communicate a point
uh-huh.
to the audience.
Uh-huh. So there was a dialogue between what you were reading outside the study and then how that helped open up some things for you to see in your action research.
Yes, and it was mainly Nancy Summers from that, I believe it was 1982, the Responding to Student Writing article.
Uh-huh.
And then there's a Richard Straub article that came out in, I think it was 1996, that was about the control, teacher control in feedback for students. And so that's where I got the idea of providing facilitative feedback rather than directive feedback to my students, so that I could still be clear about where they were in the rubric, the expectations, but I could leave it open so that they could make decisions about their own writing.
Hmm. So how did they react as you started to, your A-driven students, as you started to rewrite the terms of the game with them, in effect? It sounds like what you're doing is you know, changing the game up a bit. How did they react?
Now, I did tell them that this is what I was doing, and it was part of this research project, and I surveyed them throughout the whole thing, so that it wasn't something I just threw at them out of nowhere, which I think helped. But they were a little bit concerned Fortunately, they always knew they could revise anything that they wrote in class, so I think that helped them feel a little more comfortable anyways, that they knew if they tried something and it didn't quite work out, they could keep working through it again.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that helped. But they were a little bit worried with how open I left some of the assignments. They would say to me, well, how long is this supposed to be? And I would say, well, how long do you think it needs to be?
Mm-hmm.
And they would roll their eyes and walk away and get upset about it. But in the end, the comments that they wrote were, and you know, you'll have to look at the website, I think the listeners can do that, rather than me giving all the statistics. But the comments that they wrote, giving me feedback about the work that they did, indicated that they actually appreciated having that freedom because they actually cared about what they wrote, and instead of just revising their paper to change the things that they thought I wanted, they had more autonomy in making revisions, and that means they actually cared more about it.
So what happened to the writing?
It was so much better than any writing I'd ever gotten before because they weren't writing my papers anymore. They were writing their papers,
uh-huh.
And they were all so different. And it was exciting to get papers from the students instead of feeling like, oh, I have to grade 100 of these again. It was really interesting to get all these different papers that had their individual voices in it. And even if they weren't successful in terms of meeting the criteria for a given assignment, it was just so, I don't know, invigorating to be able to read their work.
Wow. So that's, as all the studies have suggested, that seems to open up an entire direction for you to be working through as a teacher in your classroom and more broadly now and for the next few years. It sounds like you've opened up a direction for your teaching.
Yeah, and it's definitely changed the way I would do things. And, you know, the major thing that changed is the involvement of my students in any work that I'm trying in the classroom. Because if I didn't have their feedback, I would have misinterpreted a lot of data points along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they were honest with me when I surveyed them about what was working, what wasn't working, how effective were the comments that I gave them at helping them feel prepared to revise, and that feedback was really valuable. So I'll continue to do that. I'm also interested in looking at how letter grades play a role in student writing improvement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's possible to experiment with that or not. I'll have to speak to my principal a little bit more, but I think in the meantime, something I can do is that next year I'll be teaching some classes at the same grade level that are not honors level courses, so I want to see if what I've tried with the honors students will transfer over also to that level of student. Because
mm-hmm.
it seems to me that the lower skilled writers tend to crave more directive feedback, and I don't know how they'll react to the facilitative feedback.
Mm-hmm. So one theme I'm also hearing that may translate nicely across the two is this notion of, in a way, student ownership, trying to expand student ownership of their own writing, even direct them toward more ownership, but also student ownership in the classroom in terms of a real partnership between you, the teacher, and students who are reflecting and giving you feedback through the study about how to create the conditions for better learning and writing in the classroom. It would seem that
yeah,
could translate.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I had one student who commented at the end on the final survey that he didn't feel like he improved a whole lot as a writer. He was kind of a low-skilled student to begin with in the class, but that he appreciated that I cared enough about their work to do a whole research study on it. And so that was nice to know.
Well, we're going to hear in a few minutes about some of the publishing and sharing of findings that is going on at Southern Arizona. You mentioned, Leah, that studies are online. We'll be putting links in into the chat room and onto the web for listeners so that they can read the full studies. But before we go to that, I'm just wondering whether this notion of teacher research as a way that teachers and students can be partners in thinking about an educational setting and how to improve it. Did others of you, Lori and Denise, did you experience that as well, this kind of sense of partnership with your students in teacher research?
Oh, absolutely. When I was working with the literature circles, I'm not quite sure if I mentioned, I mean, I'm pretty upfront and honest with my students at all times about everything. And when I started the literature circles, I told them that I knew that they could do the work. And they needed to show me that they were ready to do it. And putting the ownership on them and having them, like I said before, they created questions. They guided a lot of the work that we did with text. And that made them feel empowered, and that drove them even further. Mm-hmm. And I think when, as a teacher, I've learned this and have been reminded of this so many times, to kind of take a step back and listen to my students and really hear what they're saying and what they need. Because no matter, I think, and, you know, and I deal with pretty difficult students and, you know, really challenging ones that kind of come in with the I don't want to work attitude, but really they do. They want to work, and they do want to learn, and they're there to learn, but, you know, as a teacher I have to figure out, well, how can I get them there, you know, and really work on my listening skills so that I can really help them out.
And Denise, the notion of partnership with your students might apply, but I also heard you sort of mention parents and families and also the mentors. So it seems like there are many partners in your work. Is that the case?
Yes, and I really found it very valuable to be able to talk to even other teachers about my research and listening. The community of the teachers together looking at each other's studies and comparing, and it gave me ideas for what I was doing with my study, as well as their suggestions, you know, for theirs, and would send me different directions to how I looked at what my research was showing me and what they were doing. So it was really valuable to have that community of researchers together. And then also being able to talk to the parents and other teachers at my school, it really had a real collaborative effect.
Mm-hmm. So this you can hear it across all the studies, this really powerful feeling that teachers, students, families, other teachers, that together we can be a community to name problems of practice that we want to work on and work together to figure out how to improve educational settings. That really comes through. I was thinking another thing that seems like it's coming through in all your studies is the importance of some research that you read, that it wasn't just a matter of sitting there and just trying to think up things and try them, but you actually, it sounds like all of you were really in a mode to read what the research has said on your situation and the challenges that you're looking at and draw from that. Would anybody speak to that?
I know that when I was getting my master's, I had to read so many things by Stephen Krashen. And so when I started this study on oral language development and how to get students to how to increase the academic oral production, a couple of teachers mentioned that I should, you know, look at Stephen Krashen and look at, you know, the researchers that I had read over and over and over again, and I was like, oh, God, I don't want to. Only because I had read so much, and, you know, I thought I knew everything. But what was so humbling was that I went back and looked at the research, and I was like, well, I really don't know everything. And I learned so much by going back, and I, you know, funny enough that there Stephen Krashen did do research on literature circles, which is what gave me the incentive to do it with my classroom. And I'm so grateful that I, you know, took the time out to research or to look into his research about it, because otherwise I don't know if I would have come up with an answer.
Interesting. Well, I want to pick up on this theme just because we're unfortunately starting to run out of time in our hour, and I feel like we could listen to each one of you in depth for another hour. But since we don't have that time, I actually want to make a segue. Sharon, if we could bring you back, this notion of how important it was that Lori just spoke to read the research, and when you're driven by a question, all of a sudden there's stuff that jumps out of the research that maybe you even missed in a past before. You're really working at Southern Arizona Writing Project, as are other people, of course, to make sure that teacher researchers can contribute to the research as well as access it. In our last couple of minutes, we referred to the opportunity to read these studies in depth online and a few other things. Could you give us a picture of what Southern Arizona is trying to do to make the work of these amazing teacher researchers available more broadly?
Well, basically, I'm so convinced that we have an obligation to not just our local community, but to the broader educational community to share our work and make sure that the teachers' voices get into those conversations that are going on about teaching and learning. So when we ask our teacher researchers to write about their work, we're providing the kind of reading that other teacher researchers can do to enlarge their studies and to make things better. So I've always encouraged publishing. First of all, I believe that when you write about your study, it helps you to clarify and come to new understandings. And you're also sharing insights with others, so that's important. We have traditionally done things like publishing some local anthologies that teachers always had. It's not a graduate paper to write as a result because they were taking it for graduate work. Our non-graduate students wrote what were called working papers, which came from an idea of Marion Moore's, I think. And then we've had a few teacher researchers who've published articles in journals, and we held our own conference for a few years, but budget cuts kind of threw that to the wind. But we encourage our teacher researchers to present their work at state and national conferences. And this year, we really stuck our neck out and did publication online. You'll be amazed at the extensive nature of the Sunnyside School District because there were 49 teachers involved in that program. And I think all of them have published their work on multiple page sites. Now, we have a whole lot to learn about how to effectively publish studies online. And if anybody out there knows a good user-friendly platform that we can use to make dynamic sites, anyone who's familiar with the Carnegie Foundation's Inside Teaching and Gallery of Teaching and Learning, that's my goal, something that we can do similar to that. Mm-hmm. But we're very happy with what we've done, and our teacher voices are out there. They are floating in cyberspace, waiting for people to grab a hold and learn something from us, too. So We're excited about it.
And tell us, you're just using, for example, Google Sites or other kinds of general
We're using Google Sites, and it's fairly easy to use, but there are some real limitations. It's not easy to navigate from a second page to a third page. You keep having to go back to the first page. Leah was brilliant in the way she put hers together, that she put a link at the bottom of every page that would take them to the next section. But that required her to do it. And we don't have a lot of pictures and photographs and video and audio and those kinds of things that I think make a website a little more dynamic and a little more interesting. Maybe we still look like we're doing a paper report online.
But you're at the start of a journey of trying to create and recreate what it would mean to publish these findings then.
Yes.
It sounds like over the next few years, I'm guessing that this notion will just grow and develop.
And I would welcome feedback from anyone who visits our websites, anyone that would be interested in letting me know what they think and what we can do to improve it. I'm all for it.
Well, this has been quite wonderful, actually, to hear from all of you. We will make sure that, listeners, that you can find your way to these sites online so that you can read the studies and also give them the feedback that actually Sharon just asked for. I really appreciate that all of you were willing to spend this hour with us. We could have spent many more, but it's been wonderful for all of us in the Writing Project community to be able to get a look into the Teacher Research and Inquiry Program as it exists right now at the Southern Arizona Writing Project. So thank you all for joining us.
Thank you
for having us. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.